You're tuning into the Active Mom Podcast with physical therapist, Dr. Carrie Pagliano, a real mom's guide to all things postpartum return to workouts after baby. If you're a postpartum mom, coach, trainer, or physical therapist looking for answers on how to get back to running, CrossFit, yoga, Pilates, HIIT, you name it, without the fear of pelvic floor issues or doing something wrong, this is the podcast for you. Let's start the show.
All right. So a friend of mine over the summer said, you need to check out this book. It's called Built to Move. And this friend of mine, Justin Moore, he's the CEO of APTA. He lives here in Arlington as well. And he's a runner. And he's like, you know, I need to do more than running. And so I popped the audiobook in, went for a run. And one of the first things they talked about was kind of these screening items, make sure you're mobile. And it was like a sit to stand and holding on to things or doing it without hands or something like that. I'm like, oh my God, this is Mom 101. And so I reached out to one of the co-authors, Juliette Starrett, and she graciously agreed to come on the podcast. And she has a great story to tell because she's an athlete, an entrepreneur, a mom, and we're going to call her an honorary PT at this point. So Juliette Starrett,
seriously,
thanks for being on the Active Mom Postpartum Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm all about the active mom. So I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit who you are, where you live, kind of what you do, all that good stuff.
Sure. So I am professionally, I am the CEO of the Ready State, which some people may have heard of, or if people are, you know, have been around the world for a while, we used to be called Mobility WOD. But we basically help people take care of their musculoskeletal health, resolve nagging pain and injury. You know, we actually teach professionals how to sort of assess and understand movement. And, you know, so we're sort of like PT adjacent, I would say our company is. But we're really trying to work directly with consumers. And I think we really try to fit the, that sort of Neverland, where, you know, there's often people have a catastrophe and they go immediately to physical therapy, but that's sort of a 6-week thing. And then, you know, they can get back to like walking, but they can't yet get back to doing the sports and activities they love. And we try to kind of fill that void there. And so that's what I do in my day job. Kelly and I also host a podcast. We've written some books. As you said, I am a former professional athlete. And then, I mean, honestly, like many people listening to this, my main and most important job is I am the mom of two girls. And I've got a freshman in college and a sophomore in high school. So, you know, we can talk about all mom things.
We will do that. I'm going to pick your brain before we get off.
So that's, you know, that's my backstory.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of things going on here. For you, just to clarify, professional athlete, you were a professional kayaker. Is that right?
Yeah. Kayaker and whitewater paddler, which also included whitewater rafting. And for those people who don't know that whitewater rafting is a sport, it is. It's a total fringe sport, especially here in this country. Actually, if you travel to Europe and South America and some countries in Asia, it's actually like kind of a huge sport and funded by the government. And, there's been talk of making it an exhibition sport in the Olympics, but for now, it's more like a kind of, I would describe it as like an X Games type sport. Like it's an extreme sport. You paddle on the most gigantic rivers out there. The goal is to have a lot of carnage and swimming because that looks really cool on television. I did that. I was a rower in high school and then a Division I rower in college. And then went on to do this very obscure sport in my 20s for 5 years as a professional athlete.
Now, rowing it seems a lot more stable, a lot more controlled than paddling, yes?
Oh my God. I mean, there's no, it's extreme, you're exactly right. It's extremely controlled. Yeah. There's pretty much no threat of death, although I'm sure people exert themselves so hard. Maybe there's like a slight threat of, you know, like having a heart attack or something, but, you know, by and large, there's no threat of death. It's in a very controlled environment. You're rowing in these like $20,000 carbon fiber shells, in lakes. Rivers bring on this whole other element of the unknown, right? You can plan and be prepared, but you know, you don't know what the water level is going to be. You're often racing on these rivers you've never seen before. The rapids are gigantic. Oh my God. And so it really is, you know, obviously there's some overlap in like the athletic part of it, but there's not a lot of overlap in the amount of, you know, thinking, reacting, changing, you know, being responsive to what nature is, you know, throwing your way. So, you know, there was some overlap just in terms of like the suffering part of like pulling on a thing. There was overlap there, but yeah, very different. It's a lot more like, for people who like ski or mountain bike.
Okay.
It's, you know, because you know, when you're skiing or mountain biking, you have to, you know, make last minute split decisions and you have to avoid other skiers or other mountain bikers. And you have to constantly be, you know, choosing your line and making different decisions. So it really is to me a lot more like that than it is like rowing.
Gotcha. It also sounds like a good preparation for mom life. Yeah. That everything's being thrown at you.
Yes. And then, you know, it's interesting too. I just was talking to someone about this because I was doing this in the 90s, which was all pre-cell phone.
Yeah.
And I think about my mom and I'm so thankful that I did all these things I did pre-cell phone because, you know, in addition to this, you know, traveling all over the world, largely to like sketchy rivers in developing countries and going down the biggest class five rapids that are runnable. And on top of that, I was, you know, and I was working as a guide, as a river guide for many years, all over California and a little bit in, you know, Oregon and Arizona, also on really difficult, you know, class four, class five rivers.
Yeah.
And now as a mom, I'm like, oh my God, I hope my kids don't do that. I mean, of course I want them to like take risks and challenge themselves, but it's like, I think one nice thing is my mom had, I mean, she knew I was a river guide. She knew that I was competing in this sport, but you know, it was a different time in terms of access. Right. So I don't think she really had an up close and personal view of what I was really doing. So I think in a way as a mom, that was good for her.
That was a good thing.
Yeah. She really did not. It was a different time.
Well, I also love it in the book that you talk about how you met Kelly and how he basically got in a big jam and you guys helped him out because the girls are much smarter than the boys. I appreciated that aspect of the story.
Oh my God. Yes. I mean, they were so hilarious. Like, I mean, you know, that we tell the story in the book, but I mean, they scouted a rapid from a mile up, from a dirt road a mile up, and they were like, we got this. And
boys,
you know, we had this was in the year 2000 and my team had already been racing in four. This was a world championships. This was our fourth world championship.
Oh my God.
And, you know, we'd made a lot of mistakes and we had flipped a lot and swam a lot of really big rapids. So, you know, we were scared. I mean, we were very competent, but like we had a healthy amount of fear and respect for these gigantic rapids. And, you know, they were like, you know, 23, 24 year old guys, maybe they're frontal lobe wasn't completely fully developed and they were just like, let's go. So yeah, we saved them.
Well, thank you for doing that. We appreciate it.
Yes.
So how do you go from that? And like, you're at the pit of death, you know, diving through these rapids and then years later be like, hey, I'm going to, you know, dive into mom life. Like, I know there's a few years between that, but like, how do you kind of make that shift? And then how did you kind of navigate, you know, pregnancy and even postpartum, understanding this was, you know, 19, 20 years ago and we had zero guidance. We have nothing. Like,
no.
What was that experience for you?
Yeah. I mean, I've actually kind of reflected on that a little bit because now I am cresting into menopause. And so I'm sort of like obsessed with all things menopause. Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm but because I do feel like we're right on the tip of having there be a real sea change in access to information, acknowledgement of menopause, support for women with menopause. I mean, it hasn't happened yet. I think we're really at the very tip of it happening, but it actually has caused me to reflect on like the kind of support I had around my pregnancy and postpartum.
Yeah.
And in some ways it really was not great. You know, I went in as, you know, I did, I'll be honest. And I think a lot of athletes relate to this. You know, I didn't love being pregnant, in part because what I do for fun and for my mental health is to like move my body a lot. And I felt, you know, it was difficult to be slowed down in that way, you know? So I struggled just with that piece of it. Mm-hmm. And then I will say I had two really unexpectedly terrible births, which were really surprising to me because I thought, man, I'm this like hardcore lady, you know, I am going to just slay this birth thing. Yeah. You know, I'm going to push twice and these kids are going to fly out of my body. And, you know, isn't this going to be amazing? And yeah. when, a big regret I had is I went in with a plan and I don't think the people advising me did the best job of saying, it's nice to have a plan, but you really need to also be ready for these alternatives. And so actually, you know, I ended up having to have a C-section with my first daughter. And I really yep. felt that I had like it was a failure because I have this idea in my mind of myself. Yeah. I've created this vision that I'm this hardcore woman. And like, if yep. anyone can have an easy, awesome, drug-free birth, I am that person, yeah. you know? And then when that didn't happen, I didn't have a context for it.
Yep.
And so I did really struggle with that after the fact. And,
did you laminate your birth plan?
I didn't laminate it, but I definitely had one.
I did.
Oh my God, I love you.
No, but so here's the thing. Same thing happened to me, but like I'm going into it as a pelvic health PT at this point thinking I'm going to be like, hey, this is going to be great. 3-day induction, push for 2.5 hours, C-section.
Yes, me too.
And then you feel like high five. Shit.
Yeah. You got hit by a truck.
Yes.
So the recovery is different.
You're swollen. It's awful. I'm counting pain pills. Like,
yep.
And then
it just isn't what you expect.
No.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's been a piece of advice I've given to younger women I know who are still having kids is I was like, yes, like have a birth plan. You know, I'm pro however you want it, but also, man, stay flexible yes. in the mind yeah. and know that, you know, if you're hoping to have a home birth or some glorious experience, you might get to have that, right. But you might not. And that's okay too, because in the yeah. end, you know, it's like the most important thing. But I really wish that I'd had a bit more of I wish that the people around me who were supporting me, advising me, did a slightly better job. And I wish I'd known to sort of have sort of like hedge my bets a little bit in terms of what to expect.
Yeah.
I think it was unexpectedly a struggle. And then my next kid, thanks to having a C-section the first time, mm-hmm. I ended up getting placenta previa, which I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's not yeah. good.
No.
And I lost like half the blood in my body. So I had a really epic birth, lost like half the blood in my body. And so that was difficult for different reasons. But what was so difficult and what I've been reflecting on as I've been, you know, going into this menopause journey is how little postpartum support I got. And in fact, I've almost wanted to like write a note to some of my physicians because a couple of big things. You know, first of all, I think, you know, so my daughter was born 6 weeks early. I had mm-hmm. placenta previa. She was in the NICU for 3 weeks. So to me, that should be an automatic, like this person needs like psychological support.
Yes.
Not just the mom, but the mom and the dad, you know, like yep. one of the things that was so difficult is people don't know even what, after you have a really difficult birth and your kid's in the NICU, people don't know what to say to you because right. we've created this narrative that like, oh, everyone has this healthy, awesome birth and you stay mm-hmm. in the hospital for one day and you go home and congratulations. But when you say, oh, well, my kid's in the NICU and right. potentially unwell, like there's not even a social narrative to be right. able to talk about that. And so I'd have these strange interactions with people because people didn't really even know what to say, like, oh my right. God. And then I don't think that the medical people around us circled the wagons in terms of providing us with like the mm-hmm. mental and emotional support. So I'm not sure if I was in a postpartum depression, but man, was I on the precipice of that.
Yeah.
And certainly no one reached out to support me or yeah. us. And, you know, and at the time I was just like, oh my God, I have to get my baby home. I have to hold, you yeah. know, like I just was in that like mom mode. So right. I would have needed some external support of someone saying, hey, you might want to sit down and talk to someone to process this gnarly birth you had and
yeah.
this horrible physical experience. And, you know, and then just some basic stuff was really missed. Like, you know, it wasn't until my daughter was born in 2008. It wasn't until 2012 when I got some like external medical support that I realized I was like catastrophically anemic and
wow.
B12 deficient. And, you know, of course it seems so obvious that I should have just been like drinking vials of iron after losing half the blood in my body.
Right.
But again, when you're a mom, you just, you know, you get home and it's like
right.
all you can do is just keep your baby alive and function. And so, so it would have taken some sort of outside person coming in to say, hey, you might need some nutritional support and some supplemental support to get your iron levels back up after losing half the blood in your body. And, you know, hey, you might need some emotional support. And, you know, but I didn't even, I mean, honestly, you know, my daughter is almost 16. Like, I am just now having a moment to be able to think like, okay, that was suboptimal.
So it's funny that you're saying that because I inadvertently dove into perimenopause and menopause in the fall. Really long story short, I was on continuous birth control, came off of it because of high blood pressure, no period. My mom's like, oh, I had I hit menopause at 41 and I'm almost 48. I'm like, hey, that would have been really nice to know. But realizing how many parallels there are and how much we're learning about kind of perimenopause and menopause and looking back. And there's a whole generation of us that, yes, there's better care now. It's not perfect. But there's so much that our generation sort of missed out on. And I feel like we need to go back and fill those gaps.
Yes.
And it's mental health, it's physical health, it's understanding nutrition and fueling. Like, there's so many facets that we didn't get. Like, we need like cliff notes at this point to get caught up on what moms are getting now. And again, it's not perfect, but it's better than what we got. And I mean, your oldest is not that old. I mean, my youngest is 10. So we're going from 10 to 19 here. Like, that wasn't that long ago.
It's not that long ago. Like, my kids were born in this, you know, this like in the 2000s, right? They're like, it's not, they're not that old. Like, yeah, I mean, I think you're so right. And I mean, I think from a menopause standpoint, I can't emphasize that, like, I still think we've made 2% progress on what needs to be 100% progress. Yes. I think there's some voices out there that are trying to really push the needle here and get the kind of care that women need. But yeah, I mean, your story is so similar. I have quite a few friends who've gone through early menopause, been gaslit by their doctors saying, no, there's no way you'd be in menopause now. You know, and now they're in their 50s looking back and been like, wow, okay, that would have been really great if I gotten the support I needed then and wasn't told that I was insane. You know, and then I think sometimes, and I don't know if this is a generational thing, and we Generation Xers are kind of aggro, I'll say. But I feel like we often in weird ways don't support each other as women. Like, let me give you an example. This whole birth thing becomes weirdly competitive.
Oh my God.
And value based. Like, we've created this value where if you're able to give birth without drugs,
oh my God,
you get an A+. And then if you get a C-section, you've gotten a C. And then that like literally there's this value thing where if you're able to have a natural birth without drugs, like, you're better. And the women who are able to do that seem to take on a narrative that, like, aren't they amazing and awesome? And then, you know, those of us who aren't able to do that, like, we got a C in birth, like, we're kind of failures. And I think that's created by us. I don't know that that's external. Like, I think because it's this weird competitive thing.
It's and still of course, here.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think Gen X, I don't think we're gonna take the whole load on that. But, like, again, I mean, in DC, we have a lot of older moms. I'm not sure how it is for you in California.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Yeah, I mean, like, my average new postpartum patient is typically between 38 and 42. So they've had control over everything. And I find myself, even like, you know, 10, 13 years later, cringing quietly if somebody's like, oh, well, I want to have a natural birth, or I had a natural birth. Like, that word still, I'm like, you know, it's still there. And, but to your point too, like, why do we have to eat our young? Why are we having to, like, still have this like competitiveness? And you don't know what it's like. If you've never had a C-section, you don't know what it's like. I'm going to tell you, it sucks. Like, it's not a fun thing. I don't want to do it again. It's not anything I would sign up for. Not anything I wish on my worst enemy. That said, glad I got my kids. We're moving on. But for me too, like, again, I had this, like, I didn't talk about it for so long because as a pelvic floor PT, I was like, oh my God, are people going to look at me like I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, because that's what my scenario was. And I ended up with leakage and diastasis and pelvic organ prolapse and all those things. Are like, are you a shitty PT because you ended up with all these things, which isn't true, but, like, you know, it's a thing that goes through your head. You're gaslighting yourself, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I have my best friend is an acupuncturist and traditional Chinese medicine practitioner in Santa Cruz. And she's just this, like, warm and loving you know, like earthy mama. And she was able to have a successful home birth with her first child and then tried to have a home birth with her second child and ended up in the hospital and then really ended up breastfeeding and had to supplement with formula. Mm. And it was extra traumatizing for her because she, I think, felt like, well, I'm this nature mama and I'm supposed to be able to give birth naturally and, you know, breast is best. And I think because she had created this expectation of herself that, you know, this was, or this was her identity, then like, oh my God, the thought of having to like supplement with formula was like so anathema to who she was as a person and, you know, what would people think? And, man, we just really are like so hard on ourselves, right? Like, you know, I saw an article, I don't know if you saw it recently in the New York Times, but it was highlighting in Japan how they have these, I don't even know how to describe them, but like these sort of mom centers that the women can go to after birth. Yeah. And they go after birth and, you know, they're there for like 3 weeks and like all there's nurses to help with the baby and people cook them healthy, lovely food. And I mean, literally they are just expected to like chill and relax and have tons of support taking care of the baby. And I thought, man, how civilized is that? Like, you know, like, I mean, I literally lost half the blood in my body, got a C-section, was like pumped with a bunch of bags of blood, was in the hospital for one day and like sent home and was there like, good luck to you, you know? Yep. Oh yeah. And here's your baby that you're going to care for 24 hours a day without any support of any kind. So gosh, I mean, when I saw that, I was like, oh, how dreamy and civilized that is. And, you know, I wish we could, you know, I wish in our culture, we could figure out a way to support women that way.
Yeah. And there's it's here in DC, we have a lot of people sort of from everywhere and they're actually trying to build one of those centers via hotel, which is, I think, an interesting concept. I'm not sure if I would want to go to that hotel as like a regular person, but, no, I've had clients that their first generation here, their families wanted them to do that. There's some interesting nuances with that. Cause some of it is like total rest. And then, you know, to go from that straight into Western, kind of culture back to work, like that's a really big gap too. Yeah. So I feel like there's got to be a nicer way to be like, all right, let's support our moms. And then let's also not go back like full tilt and expect everything and full productivity and, you know, taking care of the kids and all that stuff at like, you know, less than 12 weeks. Like that's insanity too. Yeah. But
no, it's so insanity. And you know, other thing I wanted to tell you really quickly, since you're a pelvic floor person, is that the other thing, and I mean, this is probably a whole podcast in and of itself, and this is your area of expertise, not mine, but I mean, I literally will be at my book club and like, you know, we're talking, I mean, we talk about pelvic health all the time. I mean, like I have a friend with a prolapsed vagina and I mean, like the problems are endless. Yeah. And I'm not sure, I think they're starting to be more awareness that there are pelvic health, you know, pelvic floor health and pelvic health PTs and other support people can reach out to. But I mean, I still think we're very early on there. I think so many women are struggling with pelvic health problems without any support or even knowing that this isn't just like, okay, well, this is my life now.
Yep. No, I think that's our, I think especially the last probably 4 or 5 years, our field has gone, I think above and beyond on social media. One, because it's an easy topic to get people's attention, but I think they've done a really good job on just kind of getting a lot of education out. But at the same time, we also have access issues. You know, inevitably people are like, oh, well, my insurance won't pay for it. Like stupid shit like that, which isn't true. And just, just the barriers are awful. So for me, that's, putting a lot of free education out because I grew up in a pretty rural area. The closest major health system was 70 miles away. Like just knowing if you've got broadband, if you've got internet, you've got at least access to some information because I get DMs from women all over the world that just like, they see what we know on, you know, social media, and then they don't have access to that basic information because it's so far behind in their country. Like we just have a lot of awareness still, even though I feel like, oh my gosh, we're so much better than we were, you know, 10 years ago. There's just so much. So anytime you can talk to your friends, keep doing it. Cause that's how we're going to get somewhere.
And you know what I think is cool about that is it's easy, you know, in this modern world with all this technology to just say like technology sucks and it's ruining our kids and whatever. But I mean, man, for this kind of thing, it's really cool. It's I mean, to the, you know, like just back to the menopause thing, like I've started following all these menopause people and man, I mean, there are some like women beating the drum and they are really working hard to educate people. And I mean, that is a really cool application of social media. Like this is really, and of course there's always going to be misinformation and we all have to figure out how to combat that. And, you know, so, I mean, it's both sides, but like, it's amazing to think about like, you know, you talking about pelvic floor health on Instagram might reach someone halfway around the world and, you know, give them at least ideas about what's possible.
Yep. Exactly.
That's amazing.
And we're probably following similar because my algorithm is all like perimenopause, menopause now. But what, again, the parallels I'm pulling back to another low estrogen state, which is postpartum. And that's not anything, even, you know, even in our training as pelvic floor PTs, that was never like a huge emphasis of like, hey, guess what? You have dryness, you have irritation down there. You might have some urinary issues because there's estrogen receptors down there and maybe some local cream would be great, you know, to help out or, you know, here are all the other things that can go on in perimenopause, but also, I mean, do you remember the hot flashes in postpartum?
Oh my God.
Oh my God. No one told me about that. What the hell? Like,
Oh, I mean, I don't think anyone told, like, I basically feel like I look back and I was like I went to my birth class, you know, and you like learn about birth and you learn how to put on a diaper and stuff, but like, there's no postpartum class. Like nobody tells you what to expect, you know, you're just sort of, again, you're like handed your baby and you take your car seat away and you go to your house and you're like, well, let me figure out this new thing. Right.
We literally we put my son down in his room in his car seat. My husband and I looked at each other and we're like, okay, now what? Like, we didn't know what the hell to do. Like,
Kelly and I looked at each other like when, you know, we'd had like a, you know, night after night of sleepless nights and we looked at each other and we're like, everybody on earth does this. Like, can you believe it? Like, this is so gnarly. Like, everybody, like, why do people do this? Like, this is gnarly. And I think we're not alone in that. You know, I think everybody does have a moment of being like, holy shit, what did I just do?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that there's a day that's gone by that I haven't. No, anyway. So for you, like, okay, you get through that, those early kind of weeks postpartum. Was there a time that you were like, consciously trying to kind of find yourself again as an athlete? Like what was your process sort of kind of finding yourself physically again?
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky because by the time I had both my kids, we already owned our CrossFit gym, San Francisco CrossFit. So, you know, I did have access to training and, you know, one of, you know, again, people listening to this, you know, people seem to have extreme views about CrossFit. Like they either love it or hate it. I struggle to find anyone who's sort of in the middle ground. They're sort of like, I hate CrossFit. I love CrossFit. But man, I mean, the beauty of CrossFit in postpartum is how ultimately scalable it is.
Yeah.
And so I could show up, you know, having just had a C-section and lost half the blood in my body and look at a workout and say, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, this is what, you know, everybody else is doing, but I can scale it in, you know, duration and intensity and weight. And so I was able to get back into CrossFitting pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And again, at a very scaled level, like I remember actually after my second daughter was born, there was a workout that had push-ups and I lowered myself to the ground and I could not even do one push-up. And I remember being kind of mind blown about that. Like, oh my God, like this is where my fitness has gotten to. So I couldn't do a push-up. But I was still kind of trying to compete in CrossFit at that time. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, it was in the dawn of time of CrossFit Games, by the way. Yeah. So you could still be a normal person back then and have like a job and not be a professional athlete and you could go to the CrossFit Games. So I went to the CrossFit Games in on a team. I was on a team, but in 2010, we went to the CrossFit Games as San Francisco CrossFit and we got 10th place overall. So it was the first year, actually. It was the first year it was in Carson. So we got to the finale. They had 10 teams in the finale and we competed in that kind of main center stage. And, you know, I did some muscle ups there. That was like my first and last time doing muscle ups. So that, I think that helped me and has been something that's been so important for me as, as an athlete, as a person, is that I really thrive more when I have something to train for.
Yep.
And so I've been doing a variety of things like that my whole life. I mean, you know, CrossFit Games, you know, I got into road biking for a while when I was still in school before I had my kids. And, you know, I would sign up for like little road biking, like not races, but, you know, rides. And I've always found for myself, if I have a thing out there to train for, that it makes training all the more fun for me. Yeah. So over, you know, if I look over my lifetime, I've trained for a ton of different little things and none of them are, I mean, the CrossFit Games is like the most professional of all those things, but you know, I just did a bikepacking trip in Arizona with one of my best friends, Rebecca. I've never bikepacked. I didn't know the first thing about bikepacking. I'm a mom, so I couldn't really train for it. But what was fun about it was, you know, I like having something to look forward to. And so I think when I was postpartum, especially with my second daughter, it really helped knowing that I was like, okay, I'm trying to compete on this team. Yeah. And so it gave me something to train for. And I really think that helped me kind of regain my fitness postpartum.
Yeah. I think a lot of moms are like that. When you kind of get out of that initial haze, is you want to have something that you're working towards. And I think it's easier to be on a plan or have somebody stick a plan in front of you and be like, hey, you need to do this or, you know, you're going to be in trouble come that day. And some people get to it earlier than later. I don't think I think I did my first, I did a 10K or something within the first year after my son. And then I was like, okay, I have nothing to prove. And then eventually got back to it later on. Yeah. But it just, you know, I totally agree. It's nice to have something and it's nice to do something for yourself.
Yeah. And there's so many ways to do it. I mean, there's 10Ks and 5Ks and Kelly and I have done a bunch of Spartan races and, you know, we've done mountain bike rides and road rides. And I mean, we're all, you know, we got like, we're obviously we have a background in paddling. So we have a local paddling community. So sometimes we'll just get off the couch and go do a stand-up paddle race and get last place. And, you know, so we just are always like, we do sort of, and again, like we're all over the place. Like we'll do anything that's kind of athletic because if you're like, oh, okay, well I'm doing the Spartan race on May 1st. Like I can't sleep through my alarm this morning.
Right?
I got to get up and go do the thing. So, you know, man, I would really encourage anybody. I mean, I think generally that's a good thing to do for anyone just trying to kind of keep an athletic practice going, but definitely for postpartum women. And I agree with you. I think because to the extent that you sort of do lose a sense of identity when you become a mom and, or it's a changed identity and you're sort of grappling with what that means.
Yep.
I think, especially for those of us who are athletic and gravitate towards athletics or sports or whatever, I think sort of having this thing that you're doing is decidedly for you. And it's like, you know, the training is going to be something you do alone without your kids and your family. And it's just like a moment for you to collect your thoughts and process what's going on in your life and the changes and then really kind of regain your body because we really do. I mean, there's a lot of physical changes that happen after you give birth and are a mom.
That I'm thinking back to, you were saying, you know, kind of because you were doing CrossFit, like kind of OG in the very beginning and knowing that early on how adaptable it was. And it's so funny to me now, and I'm sure you totally appreciate this because you guys had a gym at that time and your husband's a PT, like in pelvic PT. Oh my God. 2013, when Rory, can't remember what his name was, did a video where you're like, you're not supposed to, you know, it's okay to pee when you lift. My whole field was like, it's not okay. And then, but we didn't have any solutions because there weren't a lot of us doing things. And then now you've got PTs in, have practices in gyms and people that totally specialize in just working with CrossFit athletes. It's so funny how far we've come.
Oh my God, isn't it? Yeah. And, you know, I will say too, like, I think I really, but like, I think I probably would have had more pelvic floor problems. And I definitely have a diastasis. Is that right? I don't know. I have that. But I've been able to have zero challenges with it because I've been lifting weights and have stayed strong.
Exactly.
And so, you know, so I've had some people approach me like, well, should I get surgery? And I said, look, you know, you got to do what's right for you. And, you know, if surgery is the thing that's right for you, what worked for me was lifting weights and being strong and having a strong core. Because it has been, it's been a non-issue for me because I have lifted weights from the beginning and had a strong core.
That was actually, honestly, how I got into doing CrossFit was after, not my first, but after my second, I had diastasis. And the conventional wisdom at the time was just, you know, gentle exercises, you know, not do too much of anything. And I had gone to a continuing ed course to learn more about CrossFitters because I was starting to see more lifters. And it was one of those things where the guy teaching Anthony Lowe, he's like, "Carrie, this is fine. You're just weak." And I was like, "Oh, you know," we started to lift weights. I was like, "Shit, this is something I need to do." And I happened to live a block and a half from a CrossFit box. And it took me a couple months to get enough, you know, kahunas to walk in the door. But it was one of those things where I'm like, if you don't use it, of course it's going to feel weak. Of course it's not going to feel right. And I've gotten the coordination now. It's like a little party trick. I can show people coning and doming and that kind of fun stuff too. But it's like, these things for so long were demonized. We're like, "Oh my gosh, if you have this, you can't do that." And so on and so forth. And it's so nice now that we're like, actually, no, you can go do these things and you can get stronger. And there's ways to do that. When so many years ago, like if I had known you owned a CrossFit box, you knew these things. There were women, you know, 16 years ago had no sense of this, even 13, even 10 years ago, even now. They're still being told, "Oh, you can't sit up or you can't squat or this or that," which is so kind of crazy.
No, it really is crazy to me. I mean, and I think too, you know, you make a good point. One of the questions that I got a lot when I had field, you know, potential CrossFitters who were interested was, and more women than men would ask me this question. And that was, you know, "Hey, well, I would really like to try what you're doing, what you have to offer, but I think I need to go to the gym first and get fit before I come to you." And I was like, no. Mm-mm. Like, that's what we do here. You can walk in the door with zero fitness. And you know, that's the beauty. We can scale everything we do to work for you based on where you are in your fitness level and your strength journey. And, you know, it took some convincing, but I think, you know, it is just that thing. It's so hard to step through the door. Mm-hmm. And then you step through the door once and then you're like, "Oh, okay, I can do this," you know?
Yeah. It was a year before I told anybody I was a PT, because it was only like 2016. So I'm like, I'm going to put my head down, not even tell anybody who I was. I was like, "I'm just here to learn." Yeah. And I had had hip surgery. I can't do the math there, but it was 17 years ago. So it was before kids. And if it weren't for that, like, I wouldn't be running pain-free now. So for me, it's been like life altering. And so and I also think too, going back to the menopause conversation, I feel like I've got a leg up now because I had so many years now of heavy lifting. I didn't have to wait till menopause to be like, "Hey, you don't want menopause-induced osteoporosis." I've already got a leg up on that. So I think those messages need to come back sooner to postpartum women to be like, "Hey, we need to be doing heavy lifting. We need to be doing impact. We need to be doing these things that you're going to want later on. Might as well start now." But again, like, it takes a while to kind of get that stuff filtered down through.
I think you're so right. I mean, I think, you know, there is, and that's another positive trend that's happening, is there is this, you know, very loud and clear message being sent around the internet that, you know, women in particular need to strength train more. And in fact, the data is bearing out to be true that women are doing that. I mean, the gym, you know, gym chains and the people who report on data of what women are doing are reporting that more and more women are coming in particularly interested in strength training and resistance training, which is a super positive thing. But I will tell you that I still, in my own community, do experience quite a bit of resistance to that. And again, I don't want to like keep saying things about Generation X, but I do think we are the, you know, we are very stuck in the, like, you know, 80s, 90s, like, be really skinny mindset. And I think a lot of women in our generation still really struggle and have a lot of fear around worry that they're going to get too bulky. Yes. And then I also think a lot of misinformation, like the amount of times I've had the conversation with people where I'm like, "Well, you should probably be resistance training." And they're like, "Well, I do yoga." And I'm like, "Look, I love yoga. Like, I am a fan. Like, do yoga. That is amazing." And yes, there is a little bit of loading in certain positions in yoga, but if your goal is to try to build skeletal muscle mass and stave off osteoporosis, you actually need to lift an actual weight. Like, you actually need to load. And that for some reason has been a message that I have struggled to pass on in my own community.
Yeah. I think also, I mean, if you think back, our moms were you know, in that like Jane Fonda generation, maybe like 1 pound weights, and it was always calorie deficit and overtrain. And, you know, we were being fed Weight Watchers commercials when we were 16, you know? Yeah, right. And so I think like we're trying to reconcile that space between what we saw growing up and then what we're being told now. And it's a weird space. And I think for some people, especially in that postpartum, they want to bounce back. They want to be in their, you know, pre-pregnancy jeans, and they want to look great in, you know, bathing suit and kind of all that stuff. And it's like, okay, there's so much that we understand now that there's better ways of doing this. And the, like, please don't worry about being bulky. Like, really, please.
Yeah,
don't.
I mean, I literally would tell people, I was like, hey, look, like Kelly and I would say, hey, when you start getting too bulky, like, please come talk to us, mm-hmm. you know, because I think sometimes, you know, I often have felt like I'm not the right advocate because, you know, I've been a serious athlete since I was 14 years old, and I started strength training at 14 years old. And I also think I happen to just be like genetically a more like prone to being a muscular person. And so I, you know, I want to like tell a lot of these women like, hey, you like good luck. Like, even if your goal was to try to get as muscular as me, like, unfortunately that's not going to happen. Like,
I would like, love just, that. Frankly, I like, that's my dream. It's just not my genetics.
So I do, I think there's still a ton of misinformation there, but I think you're right. I mean, I think what we're doing now is telling, you know, telling women as they're cresting into perimenopause and menopause, like, you should start lifting weights. But I think you actually have hit the nail on the head. Like, the time for that is actually postpartum.
Yeah.
I think there's so many benefits to the postpartum body from a pelvic floor standpoint and just a mental health standpoint. And, you know, there are a thousand reasons why strength training postpartum, I think, are so valuable. And then you're right. You already are ahead of the game in terms of doing one of the most important things you can do to stave off, you know, osteoporosis, osteopenia, and, you know, all the, and, you know, the sarcopenia and all the other related, you know, menopause things.
I'm even thinking before that, the fact that your girls got to see you and they probably grew up in your gym.
Yep.
And they probably see that as incredibly normal.
Yep. I think that, I mean, people, one of our strategy as parents, I mean, we do, I think, two things as parents with respect to movement. One of them is we just model. You know, we've always had, even though we've owned a commercial gym for almost our entire lives, we have, you know, even though we don't have a commercial gym anymore, we have a gym here in our studio where we film our videos. So we've always like we've always owned a gym as long as our kids have been alive, but we always still have had a home gym because we really want to make sure that like our kids see that it's, you know, that it's like movement and strength training and exercising is like a big part of our lives.
Yep.
And by the way, for anyone listening to this who's postpartum, I mean, I could not be a bigger fan of the home gym, and I'm not talking a Peloton because that gets sad and lonely. you know, I'm saying like a home gym is like, you know, even in the almost 20 years we owned a gym, I mean, I worked out in my home gym, especially when my kids were young, way more than I worked out in my commercial gym. So I'm such a fan of the home gym, by the way. But then I think the second thing we did in terms of movement in our household is, you know, our style of parenting was to have boundaries and then a lot of choice within those boundaries. And so our philosophy and what we told our kids is, hey, whether or not you move is not a choice.
Right.
How you move is a choice.
Yep.
So in our family, we value movement. It's like one of our core values. You've got to move your body as a human being.
Yep.
But there are a thousand ways you can move your body. The how is your choice.
Yeah.
And we will support the how however you want. I mean, our kids have taken gymnastics and ballet and jujitsu and karate. And I mean, and literally like any, we were like, we will drive you. We will support you.
Yeah.
We will get you to literally anything that is physical activity. And when they're little, we told them like, it's gotta be, and like, it's gotta be organized because you're a kid and you're not going to do it on your own.
Right.
And so our kids did swim team and volleyball. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you name it, like everything, we were like, look, not a choice whether or not to move. Like movement is, it's a must.
We have the same rule. Like every quarter you have to be doing something. I don't care what it is, but you're doing something. And now because they're older and they're doing a lot of things, I've got to figure out how to get my movement in while I'm, you know, in between the chauffeuring.
Yeah. Well, so. I don't know if you've seen my videos, but I, because you know, now my daughter's a very serious water polo player. And so Kelly and I joke around that, you know, someone asked me recently, like, well, what are your hobbies? And I was like, well, I'm a, like basically a full-time water polo spectator. Like that's my life. Like that's what I do. I'm like a youth sports spectator. But you can see on my Instagram 1,000 videos because every youth sport involves a lot of waiting around. There's a game and then there's a ton of time in between. And what we do is religiously walk. Same so here. We're always at high schools where we're at a high school pool. There's always a track. So we'll watch our daughter's game. And then in the 2 hours of waiting between the next game, we'll go walk the track and we'll bring a Frisbee and throw. And now we've gotten this crew of other parents on our kids' water polo team who always come and walk with us. So we get this lovely benefit of like moving and catching up with our, you know, the other parents on our kids' teams and gossiping and getting some sunlight on our bodies. And, you know, what's awesome is that like nowadays on the days when my kids have tournaments or, you know, weekend stuff where I haven't had a chance to do like a formal workout, you know, I'm often getting like 20,000 steps. And I think, okay, well, that is good enough. Like that's good. Like that's like, I'm checking the box on movement, you know, and what I'm not doing is packing my lawn chair and setting it up next to the pool and sitting there for 9 continuous hours, which I see a lot of parents doing.
Yes.
And so I just think, man, simplify it. And it's like, sit there while you're watching your kid's game, which is like 45 minutes or an hour. And then when you're in those waiting periods, which every sport has, walk.
But that's a skill that I think if you learn that early, and I think it's hard when your kids are small because they need the adult supervision, but the first couple of years they can kind of do it on their own and you can kind of step away. I think you get kind of complacent and you're like, oh, well, I'll just watch practice. I hate my daughter does indoor. So winter swim here, we do it indoors here out east, but in the summer they have summer swim. And I can't sit indoors in the indoor pool. One, the bleachers are horrible and it's too hot. And so my dog and I, we just walk. We walk. Yeah. We can get like 2.5 miles in while she's in practice. Like, but you have to plan it ahead.
Yeah.
So you're like, all right, I have the stuff on. I know exactly what I need. And then in summer, we actually had an episode of the podcast where we have a whole group of summer swim moms. One mom started walking just during practice and then other moms started to join her. And then it became like a whole thing that we're able to kind of stay active and keep going. And so I think the sooner you can kind of plant that seed to be like, hey, just throw your shoes in, don't put your flip-flops on. And I know you hate flip-flops, but
Well, and you're right. I mean, it just takes
running
like,
shoes. Like, yeah, it doesn't like, take that
much. Yeah. And it just takes kind of one person to be the catalyst. And maybe if you're listening to this, be that person, because we were that person for our sort of swim community. And now it's like, you know, we, you know, like our kids have to be at their water polo games an hour early. And so we literally, we all meet up in the parking lot and everyone's like, who's going to walk? Who wants to walk? And then we all go walk. And, you know, sometimes there's 10 parents and sometimes there's 5. And, you know, it's just like, it's just now become like a thing that we do as a group, but there needed to be a catalyst. And that catalyst was me saying, hey, does anyone want to go walk the track? And now it's like a given. And it really is like, you just feel so much better. I mean, I actually sometimes come back from these water polo games. We're gone all day. I've walked 20,000 steps. I'm like, man, I'm exhausted. It's just walk around the track and walk around and, or walk around the town or whatever.
Same thing here. Like we have weird winters here back east, but like we've had a couple nights and weeks where, you know, it's in the teens and there's wind chill. And I'm like, you know what? I could sit in the car or I can just go. So guess what? Wear a heavier coat, put the dog in a coat, like just go. But again, just don't think about it. Make it brainless. Just go.
And there's a little pre-planning, especially if there's weather involved, there's a little pre-planning. Yep. But you know, the other thing that I did when my kids were more like your kids' age, elementary school, is I started this thing at my school called a walking school bus. And I'm such a fan of this because I read, we had actually been doing what everyone else was doing when my older daughter was little, which was packing up in the car and going to the drop-off lane. I personally find the drop-off lane to be like the most depressing place on earth. You know, it's like I volunteered at the drop-off lane, you know, being the one who opens the door. And it's like, you just see the worst of everybody. The parents are stressed.
Oh, our kids
are stressed
here.
The kids like roll out the door. Kids are late for school. They're crying. They don't want to get out. You know, kids are fighting with their parents. It's like you get this little bird's eye view into like whatever. And I have a friend who's a marriage and family therapist. And actually when people have little kids and are in our office for marriage and family therapy, the prime complaint they have is that their mornings as a family are really stressful. and that it sets the tone for the day poorly for everybody in the family because they're all rushing and nobody's in time and they're late for school and they're running into the car and the parents go off to work frazzled and the kids start to work, start school frazzled. And so I started to kind of become aware of this and I knew how much I hated the drop-off lane and the whole process. And I started doing a little research and realized that like in the United States, most kids, like something like 85% of kids live within 2 miles of their elementary school, which is a walkable distance. And when we were kids in the 70s, I think 85% of kids walked or biked to school. And now it's something like 15%. And in fact, even during my tenure at my kid's school, we had to allocate something like $50,000 to improve the drop-off lane, which really slayed my soul. I was like, why are we spending $50,000 on this? You know, because people have just sort of, it's like a given, like the drop-off lane's a thing. And so we decided to just start walking with our daughter. And the only change we had to make as a family is we had to wake up 10 minutes earlier. That's it. 10 minutes, not a half an hour, 10 minutes earlier. We had to set our alarm for like 6:35 instead of 6:45. And then we would make our daughter, you know, lunch and whatever, breakfast, and then we would all walk to school. We didn't even do it as a group yet. And we had this lovely experience. Like we would pick flowers for the teachers and we would pet dogs and we would be outside and we would do it rain or shine, by the way. Like if it was raining, we'd put on our boots and raincoats and still walk in the rain. And we had this, it was just this lovely time to connect as a family and talk to our kids and no one was on phones. And then by the time Kelly and I, you know, our kids had gotten like 3,000 steps. And by the time Kelly and I got home, we'd gotten like 6,000 steps and it was 8:15 in the morning. And I did have some parents say to me, oh, well, you know, I can't walk my kid to school because I work. And I was like, dude, I work. And actually I have a commute so I can still walk my kid to school and then commute 45 minutes and still be at my office by 9 a.m. So it is possible.
It's doable.
So I realized that, you know, we could just start this walking school bus. So we put out some flyers and just said, rain or shine, every single day, we will be at this corner at 7:55. If you want to drop your kid here, we'll make sure your kid gets safely to school. That's and awesome. It just turned out to be the coolest thing. We met all these parents we wouldn't have met. At first, parents were dropping their kids off, and then we saw them start parking and deciding to do the walk with us. You know, we would have like, we had some days where we had as many as like 40 kids walking in our group. And, you know, and days where there were two kids. I mean, it was a real, you know, it was really a real ebb and flow. And it was just a lovely way to get some movement in. We entered the school through the back, through this beautiful field. Our kids were prepared to learn. We had a lovely connected start to our day without all the frazzle. And it was just that one, literally, we just like the only action it took by our family was deciding we want to do it and set our alarms 10 minutes earlier. That was sort of the two like action items. That was it.
Walking your kids to school is life altering. We're so lucky. Our home is probably less than a half mile from our elementary school. And so we've always walked the kids to and from school. It's one of my favorite times of day because when I'm walking to go pick, well, now it's just my daughter, but going to pick her up, that's when I change hats and go from like work mode to parent mode. And the dog gets a little walk in and she's like, you know, tell me everything on the way home. I hear all the secrets, like on the other side.
Yeah, all the school gossip.
Yes. You hear all of it. And with middle school, my son takes bus partway and then walks the rest of the way home. And sometimes he's like, hey, can you just come meet me and we can walk back together? I'm like, yes, please.
Yeah, you're like, yes, please. Oh my God, how long will this last? Yeah, exactly. I know we were sad too, because in where we live in middle school, they all just start taking the bus and it's like, it's part of like the social thing too. So, you know, we had to acquiesce to that, but man, for that little period of time of elementary school, man, it was sweet and lovely. And we were just able to really connect with our kids in a lovely and non-rushed way. It was great.
Yeah. No, for us, it's been amazing for sure. But it, to this point, like it's the simple things. And that's what I really liked about Built to Move, because it was just these tiny little simple things. And then the first one that really just kind of made me so happy and smile was the sit to stand. So can you talk a little bit about kind of what inspired you guys to kind of come up with the book and a couple of these items and kind of what sort of inspired you to kind of give this mobility practice and guidance?
Sure. I mean, I think the inspiration was a couple of things. I mean, the first is that you are obviously familiar with our first book, Becoming a Supple Leopard, which is like 150-pound textbook that does really, like, it's a beautiful coffee table book or a place to put your laptop if you're trying to create a standing desk. And, you know, and it was a revolutionary book in a thousand ways, but also not for everybody.
Yeah.
Certainly for a niche group of people who are, you know, PTs, coaches, practitioners, serious athletes, like, yeah, you know, it's not for everybody. And what we found is that even though our expertise and what we do as a company is, you know, physical therapy, musculoskeletal care and health, that, you know, I'm a certified nutrition coach and we owned a gym. And so we became like the source for our friends and neighbors for all health info. You know, we were constantly being asked, well, should I intermittent fast? And what about the keto diet? And should I paleo? And what about Mediterranean diet? And should I be a vegan? And, you know, and then people were asking how to train and how much to train. And, you yeah. know, and, you know, should I get an ice bath? And, you know, what supplements should I take? You know, we just kind of became like the node in our community of all things health and fitness. And, mm-hmm. you know, and we are nerds about it. So we at least have some advice on almost yeah. all these topics. And this is what we spend our weekends reading and researching. And we have our podcasts. We talk to a lot of experts. Yep. So, you know, we're like generalists, right? We have a lot of knowledge about a lot of things. But the other avatar of people would be like, you know, all the like 45-year-old dads in our neighborhood who throw their back out or be like, oh my God, Kelly, what do? I just threw out my back. Right. So we had those kind of like musculoskeletal.
At least they asked. Challenges.
Yeah. And we didn't have like a resource to hand to people. And Supple Leopard was just too much, too complicated. You know, we weren't going to give that book to like our grandma and our mom and, you know, right. our, like my dear friend who is like an amazing CEO of an ad agency and likes to like walk and do Peloton. Like she's not going to read Becoming a Supple Leopard. And so we really realized that there was like, you know, first of all, we'd come to realize in our own life that there were some just really simple health behaviors that we were practicing consistently that really like were the biggest levers.
Yeah.
And that we felt like people were being fire hosed with information on the internet, were overwhelmed and confused, weren't sure how to cut through the noise about what actually is important and what's going to move the needle. So we just felt like we had sort of something to say there. Yeah. And we wanted to create something more accessible. And so the sort of criteria of what we put in the book was, you know, was it science and evidence-based, mm-hmm. You know, the advice? And was it actionable? Could you improve on it? Because we didn't, you know, like one of the things people may have heard, you know, in the internetosphere is like VO2 max is one of the greatest predictors of your overall health and longevity. But we didn't want to put VO2 max in our book because, you know, to get a VO2 max test is completely inaccessible. It, you know, it's like $500 and, you know, it's only for the very few who can do that. And so we really wanted to make sure that it was actionable and accessible. And so with that criteria in mind, we came up with the 10 tests in the book. Mm-hmm. But we also really wanted to bias some of this mobility work because we feel like people at least know that whether they do it or not, they should, you know, eat some vegetables and sleep and exercise. And, you know, people know, and we still dive in there and give some lifestyle yeah. advice on all those subjects. But what people really don't appreciate, is that, you know, man, like you need a body that's going to work for you. And yeah. we're all living longer and we're probably going to live to 90. And that what people really want is a body that works for as yep. long as they're alive. Yep. And I think I would equate it to like, imagine, you know, you were like given by your dad, like your dream car at 16 years old. And you were told, okay, this is the one car you're going to get your entire right. life. So how are you going to treat it, right? You'd get the oil changed and you'd wash it and you'd maintain it. And, you know, if it broke, you would fix it. I mean, right. And so I think maybe sometimes we don't have that mentality when it comes to our mobility in our body, mm-hmm. which is so critical as we age. And so the reason that we chose chapter one being the sit and rise test, and I'll describe how to do it if you're listening, you basically stand in sort of an open area and you cross your legs and you under control, lower yourself to the ground without putting a hand or a foot down. And then you reverse that from a cross-legged position, you sort of reach forward and stand back up. And ideally, you can do that without putting a knee or putting a hand down. And sort of each point of contact you put down, you technically lose a point in the test. And this test was developed by some researchers in Brazil who were able to show that people who were able to lower themselves and stand back up without a bunch of points of contact actually lived longer, and not just a little bit longer, like 7 years longer. So we felt like the reason it was so important to start with this test is that most people are like, mobility, huh? I don't care about that. Like, why should I care about that? But it is really so eye-opening when you do it, because I'll be honest, when I first tried it, I couldn't do it either. And it's just very eye-opening because, you know, sitting on the floor is something we all did as kids. You know, you see people around the world sit on the floor to eat, and, you know, cultures eat and sleep on the floor comfortably without any problems. And I think it's really eye-opening when people see how difficult this test is, which actually doesn't even require you to express full range of motion. It only requires you to express like slightly less than full range of motion to be able to do it. Yep. And so I think we loved it because it's just, like, we felt like it gave people some really fast, really important information about how stiff and immobile their bodies may have become. Yeah. And then the other reason we liked it so much is that, number one, you can improve. I'm the classic example. I could not do it at first, and I learned how to do it with practice. And then number two, the best way to get better at it is to actually do it sometimes, which is practicing getting up and down off the ground. And then the second way to get good at it is to actually just sit on the floor sometimes.
Yeah.
And man, we are such advocates of floor sitting. I mean, you know, we know a lot of people listening to this are probably lucky enough to work from home. If you're working from home, you can, you know, ideally spend part of your day sitting on the floor, working at your coffee table. Or we also know that the average American is spending 3 hours a day watching television or Netflix. So that's another great time to just say, okay, I'm going to take 30 minutes of my favorite show and I'm going to sit on the floor while I do this. And, you know, what we see is people naturally move and change positions when they're on the floor. They sit 90-90, long sit, kneel, you know, all that fidgeting that you naturally do to make sitting on the floor comfortable is actually a great way to sort of secretly mobilize your hips.
Yep.
And so the last point I'll make, and the reason why people should care, is that, you know, the number one reason why people end up in a nursing home is they fall and they can't get back up. So if that's a skill we need to have, we should be practicing it. It's a use it or lose it scenario.
Yep.
And the other thing I think is, to the extent that maybe your listenership is more women than men, I don't know, but my guess is that it is. We women, and having had it myself, live in mortal fear of breast cancer. I had breast cancer at 45. I think it's something like one in four of us will get breast cancer. And it's a looming fear that I think all women have.
Yeah.
But what I learned recently is that our chance of dying from falling and breaking a hip as we get older, because, you know, when you fall and break a hip after like 70 years old, you have like a 60% chance of dying within 2 years. I mean, a fall when you're over 70 is a serious death risk. Well, it turns out your risk of dying from that is equal as a woman to dying of breast cancer.
Wow.
But you can't really do much about avoiding breast cancer. Obviously there's some healthy habits that you can, you know, use in your life to hope you avoid some cancer, but as you know, being exhibit A of someone that, can show that those things don't always stop you from getting cancer.
Yeah.
But man, not falling as an older person, we is completely preventable, 100% preventable with practice. So, you know, it's like, there's only so much you can do. You can just hope for the best that you're not unlucky and get cancer.
Yeah.
But man, you do not have to hope for the best when it comes to being able to get up and down off the ground. You can control whether you can do that, and then that whether or not that's a skill you maintain as you age.
Yeah.
And it's so critical. So that's why that was a way too long answer of why we started the book with that chapter.
But you know, I love a couple things that you hit on there that I think, and again, as I was listening to you guys narrate the book, my mind got to going about why this concept is so relevant to postpartum women. One, because it's one of the first times that we're faced with navigating a huge physical issue if you haven't been injured. Another is you're going to be on the floor a lot with your kid. And, you know, the sit to stand one, like how many moms need to get up off the floor holding a baby and, you know, something else. And like, these are just all things that like we need to do as young moms, I fold my laundry on the floor watching TV. I make this big old circle. Yeah. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I was like, if we can start to establish some of these habits early on and continue to do them, it's very similar to what we just said about lifting heavy. Like if we can establish this stuff early on, then we don't have to learn this stuff later on. We don't have to, like, it's kind of about prevention. If you think about it,
it really is. You know, one story I'll tell you is I was on a podcast with a sort of famous CrossFit guy, and he'd recently had a baby, and both of his, you know, his mother and his mother-in-law came together to, at the same time, to sort of help them take care of the baby. And his mother couldn't get up and down from the ground. Right. And his wife's mother could. And it wasn't until we had the podcast and talked about this test where he realized the striking difference in their ability to be able to care for the grandchild.
Yes.
Just the one who could get up and down off the ground, because his wife's mother could sit on the ground and play with the baby on the ground and get up and down from the ground. And, you know, his mother could sort of needed to be handed the baby from the ground and then could walk around and carry the baby and care for the baby that way. But, you know, that's pretty striking, right? Like, even if you're not postpartum, like, man, I'm very not recently postpartum. In fact, I'm probably closer to having grandchildren than I am to being postpartum. But, you know, man, I really want to be able to, you know, be functional and be able to sit on the ground and play with my grandkid. Yeah. You know, I mean, that seems like a pretty important thing to be able to do. Yeah. And it is a use it or lose it kind of scenario. Like you've got to practice and care about making sure your joints do what they're supposed to be doing in life.
Very much. Very much. No, I'm thinking of my mom in particular. She, both my parents started working out running when I was in high school to kind of keep up with me, to find me on the cross country trail or cross country ski trail or something like that. Kept going with that. Unfortunately, my dad's had Parkinson's for almost 25 years now, but my mom's in a very big, caregiving situation. They live in their RV. So she's driving, she's doing all the maintenance, all the stuff and kind of taking care of him. And I think it was last winter, I think she broke her ankle mountain biking too. So I'm like, okay, this is what I'm working
amazing,
with.
By the way.
She is. My mom's pretty badass. But again, like she started kind of working out. She was a teacher. She went to work early and then worked out in the gym. Like this is back in like the late 80s, early 90s when moms weren't doing that. Like, but now she's in a situation where she still has these massive physical demands, but she can do it. You know, and I look at that and I'm like, these aren't things you anticipate. You'd never want to have to be a caregiver for a spouse or things like that. That was never anything any of us would have chosen, but she can do it. And they're able to continue to live this lifestyle because she has the capacity physically to do these things. So it's prevention, but it's also your insurance policy that if something does happen, you have the ability to handle it. So I love that you make it so simple, so actionable, so like not hard. Because again, the other thing too, I think when people, you know, try new things, they want to do all the things all the time. And you guys are very clear, like, hey, if you want to break this up and do one a week, if you want to do everything all at once, like just keep it simple. And you give really nice, progressive, it's very kind of CrossFit inspired. Like there's modifications. You don't have to start at the hardest part.
No.
I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was really sort of, again, accessibility was just like at the core of this. And I think one of the things that's fun is that every single chapter has a test that you can take. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, you're going to have a few tests where you get like a green light, like you crushed it. Like, you know, it's not an area of concern for you.
Right.
And so that's one of the things you can kind of sort out. Maybe you want to revisit it to make sure you revisit it once a year or something. Yep. But I think what's so hard is we all have to make choices, right? Nobody, especially moms and especially working moms, we don't have time to say, okay, yes, there's 25 health habits I need to practice every single day. Impossible, not going to happen, right? So we all have to make these choices about what to keep and what to discard because of time demands. And so what I like about the format is that you can test yourself in all these areas and it helps you make those choices because it will show you where you have blind spots or you get like a red score in certain areas and you think, okay, well, man, I can't even sit in the cross-legged position on the floor. Like this is probably something I should keep an eye on. Or, you know, man, I just tracked my food and I realized that I eat 50 grams of fruits and vegetables in the day. Maybe that's something I should keep an eye on, right?
Yeah.
And so I think I think it's, you know, we're one of our goals was try to help people sort through the noise mm-hmm. and give them some really objective ways to say, okay, look, I'm basically taking this. I'm taking Built to Move as an at-home physical. This is like an at-home physical. I, you know, our hope is that people will revisit it like once or twice a year, retest themselves, come back, you know, retest and, you know, just kind of keep an eye on it and then, help you choose what is important for you to work on.
Yes. I think that's so key. And that's one of the things I actually do in my practice. Like we could do all these things, but at the end of the day, I need you to find within yourself what matters to you. And, but also see for yourself, like, don't just trust me in what I say. Like you need to, especially like, I love a good test retest. Like if you see, oh, that didn't go well, I don't like that. Then you're going to be, I think, more internally motivated to do something to change it when you're the one doing the prioritization. So I'm a huge fan of that. I think
people will be surprised. Like I think people experience surprise. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I kind of brought up the nutrition chapter and, you know, you see Sinkowski who inspired our 800 gram challenge in the book. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can't tell you, like I live in Marin County where people are quite privileged. It's the home of the farmer's market. We have access to plenty, like there's no access problems for like fruits and vegetables here. None. So, you know, that's my community. The amount of people who have, you know, spoken to us and reported shock at how few fruits and vegetables they were eating on a daily basis. And, you know, and again, there's no access problem where I live. That's not a challenge. It is a challenge for a lot of people. And that's a different conversation for sure. Yep. But in my community anyway, I think, you know, that was a real like aha moment for a lot of people. Like, oh my God, they were sort of like, I eat so healthy. And then when they really actually measured it, they're like, oh my God, I'm eating 100 grams of fruits and vegetables a day. And in many cases, the women I know are eating 30 to 50 grams of protein a day. Like it's nowhere near what they need, especially as they crest into perimenopause. Menopause. So I think, you know, we're hoping as people read through the book, they just have these little aha moments and are like, okay, this is an area that I forgot about, didn't know about, ignored that I now need to put some attention towards.
Yeah. That's awesome. I'm cringing inside because I have a colonoscopy on Friday. And so I'm not supposed to eat fruits and vegetables today and only liquids tomorrow. And I'm like, now I'm hungry.
Oh my God. I know. That's the real,
like, what do I do without my veggies?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. Kelly just had to have his, and he was like, "Man, nothing makes you feel older than having to have a colonoscopy."
Right? Oh my goodness. we'll have a whole episode about that later. All right. At the end of every episode, we ask everybody some questions, and I might add in some special ones for you too. First, here, what's a book you're reading or podcast that you're listening to right now?
I just finished a book called The Lincoln Highway. It's sort of like a Huck Finn style, like hero's journey. More recent book by Amor Towles. I'm someone who, when I read a book, if I don't like it in like 50 pages, I'll discard it. Like I'm not going to force myself to read a book. Well, I was like immediately invested in this book in like chapter one or chapter two, already invested in the characters and the story. So, I know as moms, sometimes we have like four brain cells left. And so we don't have time to read like dense tomes. Yes. That require like forced reading. I found this book to be ultimately like readable and a page turner. So I recommend that.
I will take that. I go back and forth between like work related stuff and then like total brainless. So I just, I have to, I'll put that on the list. Awesome. All right. Favorite activity since becoming a mom, and it doesn't have to do anything with your kids if you don't want it to.
Yeah, it doesn't. I learned how to mountain bike when I was 44. Cool. So I'm 50 now. So it's been about 6 years. And, you know, I wanted like another kind of nature sport that I could do. And we live in Marin County where there's access to a lot of trails. And so, I will say that I was literally the worst mountain biker ever. When I started, I could barely like make it up a fire road. So it was a long journey of becoming a functional mountain biker, but yeah, I love it. It's just like, I bike with friends and, you know, I'm outdoors in nature and my learning curve will continue. So it's always nice to do something where you're learning. Like I've gotten to be quite a proficient mountain biker, but I'm still not good. So there's still a lot of learning to do, which makes it interesting. So that's cool. My favorite activity.
That's awesome. I'm a little too scared with biking. I just started trail running. So we're going to start with our feet on the ground first before we hop up on anything.
I think that's a good plan.
Exactly. All right. What's one thing you wish you'd known as a young mom that you know now as an experienced mom?
Man, I mean, I just maybe don't get so worried about things with respect to your kids. Like, I'm a worrier by nature.
Yeah.
But I really got caught up in like deep worry about things. Like, will my kid get into college? Or, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just really got kind of fired up and caught up in maybe a heightened amount of worry about things that in retrospect, totally worked out.
Yep.
And again, I don't know, maybe that's just the mom's condition. Maybe there's nothing to do about that, at all. So I look back on a lot of times where I felt very keyed up and worried about my kids, mm-hmm. where I did not need to be worried. It worked out. They were fine.
Yeah. I would agree with that one, you know, diving into, with one in middle school and I almost long for the days that all I had to worry about were diapers and what he ate and sleeping and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like like one example I'll give is like in middle school, especially with girls, like girls are assholes. Right. And there's all these weird social dramas and weird changes of friends and social stuff and kids can do whatever. Like there's all that social dynamic. And I remember just getting like so keyed up and upset about stuff that was going on in like middle school girl social stuff. And I look back and I was like, why was I so stressed about that? Like, that's just part of the thing, you know? So
we're trying to shut that down in elementary already. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so tired of listening to this with my daughter. All right, here's one specifically for you. What's it like being married to a physical therapist? I chose not to marry a PT.
Man, I think maybe two would be too many.
I think so too.
You know, I think what I'll tell you is, you'll appreciate this as a runner, and this is a negative of being married to a physical therapist, and that is that I can barely watch recreational runners.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're all over our neighborhood and we live in a place with nice weather. So there's a lot of recreational runners and man, the running mechanics of the people in my community, there's every so often there are 10% of them have nice running mechanics. But the rest of them, it's like, I kind of barf in my mouth a little bit seeing the future of the, you know, Achilles and ACL tears and hip problems they're going to have. So I wish that I wasn't able to see that. I wish he hadn't taught me that.
Let me give you maybe a hint here on how to maybe look at it differently. Go at it with a sense of curiosity of, wow, isn't that interesting that looking like that, they can still run. Like that's kind of how I've shifted, because otherwise you drive yourself crazy.
It is. You drive yourself crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's so interesting because I, you know, it's, you're right. I think that's a much more positive spin on it, because sometimes I'm like, oh my God. I mean, and the only other thing I think too, which is, you know, it's not a nice thought, but I think, well, Kelly and I are going to have a job forever because look at those people running. Like,
you know what though?
Like, we're going to be employed forever.
I also look at some of these marathoners that, you know, like they're super, super, like, especially the Kenyans, a lot of the form is all over the place and they're so damn efficient. I'm like, maybe we don't know what the hell we're talking about. So I try and come with it with a sense of curiosity.
I need to do that.
Otherwise it's going to be too depressing.
It is. I'm like, oh my, I'm driving, just like driving home from work and I see someone on the side of the road. And I'm like, oh my God. Oh, so
curiosity. That's
I'm like, no, thank you. I'm just going to say no, thank you to Kelly for teaching me that. No,
thanks. Thanks, Kelly. All right. For you, and we'll tweak this a little bit, like who's somebody, not necessarily pregnancy postpartum, but like who's somebody in kind of your space that you're really obsessed with right now?
I mean, this isn't pregnancy postpartum, although I think apropos of our conversation that a lot of the recommendations should be started pregnancy postpartum, I think Stacey Sims is a must follow. Because she, and I really enjoyed her book Next Level. In fact, if I would recommend all women in their 30s who were postpartum read that book so that they can start employing those practices before they've already lost their muscle mass and before they're already in osteoporosis or osteopenia. So, you know, and I think she's just a really smart and savvy voice for all things women, women's sports, but, you know, definitely as women are transitioning into menopause postpartum, I think she's a must follow.
Yeah. And that's where, I mean, I'm trying to think when Roar came out, was like 2016 or something. Yeah. I mean, and she was one of the first voices to just kind of have some of these conversations and, and again, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but the environment, like the playing field was just so different and we were still just trying to get a seat at the table. And yeah. I think when you look at it historically, it's like, yeah, you know, the fact that people were starting, like she was starting to have that conversation was super, super cool. So,
and cool. She, by the way, did, I mean, her book, her menopause book, Next Level, came out last year, but I think mm-hmm. sometime in the last couple of months, she just released a second edition, an updated yes. edition of
just
Roar.
Updated Roar. Mm-hmm.
So, yep. I actually haven't, I have a copy of it. I haven't had a chance, but I know it has, I mean, I think the research landscape in particular, since she first released that book, has been massive yes. and positive. Yep. So I think she's, you know, fully updated it. So, yep. Yeah, I mean, she's a must follow, in my opinion, on Instagram. And, you know, and then if people have a little more time to dive into her books, I would recommend yep. those.
Yeah, awesome. All right. And then last one, what does it mean to you to be an active mom in postpartum? Understanding that postpartum can be a long time.
Oh my God, it really, yeah, it is a long time. Yeah, I think one recommendation I would have is to think about it in, you know, sort of like seasons and yeah. be flexible and willing to change. Yep. Because, you know, what you want to do, have time to do, and are capable of doing when your kids are little is vastly different. And I think, you know, as the years progress, you start to have more time and openness to be able to try new things and, you know, add different physical activities to your life or mental activities, whatever that means. And so I think just being, you know, no, just knowing that there's going to be a lot of different seasons and there may be some, you know, early times where you don't have as much time to yourself. But that will come. And in fact, one of the most important things my dear friend TJ once said to me, because I was like, my daughter was in like fourth grade. I had to go to Reno for like a 3-day volleyball tournament where I would have to be inside the entire time. And I was feeling kind of emo about that. And he said, hey, you know, his kids are a bit older, like kind of the same distance as your kids yeah. and mine. And he said, hey, there's going to be a day where your kids are gone and you're going to wake up on a Saturday and you wish that you had a volleyball tournament to go to yeah. in Reno for the whole weekend. And that completely shifted my mindset. Yep. Like that was one of the most important parenting things anyone's ever said to me, because ever since then I am like all in. It doesn't matter if I have to drive to like Stockton to go to a water polo thing on a Saturday. Like I'm yep. like, this is awesome. This is this short period of time. And I can yeah. tell you, having a daughter who's just gone off to college, yeah. it is and seems so cliche. It goes by so fast.
I used to hate that. And this yep. last couple of years, I have felt that acutely. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the shift to middle school. And then next year we'll both be in middle school. And I feel that acutely.
Yeah.
And
it is, it's hard not to talk about it and have it just feel yeah. so cliche, but it really is yep. significant as moms. And it's very hard. It's another transition when they yeah. leave.
Yeah.
Which is difficult.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's such good advice. And I think that the more that moms hear that sooner, not in a condescending way or not in like a judgment sort of way, or that like one phase is better than the other, but just like in the beginning, we don't think of it as the long game. We're just trying to survive. And if you're in survival mode for the whole time, you're going to miss something, you know? So like,
yeah, exactly.
No, I love that. All right. If you want to know more about Juliet and Built to Move, you can find her on Instagram, and also at the Ready State too. So Juliet Starrett, thank you so, so very much for being on the podcast and sharing all your wisdom and stories and all that good stuff. So thanks so much for being on.
So fun to be on, Carrie. Thank you so much for having me.
Did you enjoy the podcast? If so, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and tell a friend to do the same. Are you a postpartum mom or postpartum pro wanting to know more about getting back to running after baby? Check out all my free goodies on carriepagliano.com. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Carrie Pagliano and her guests to the show. The content should not be taken as medical advice and is for entertainment purposes only. Always consult your healthcare professional for any medical questions.